Hey, everybody, welcome to the PC Perspective Podcast. This is episode 205, recorded on June 6, 2012. I'm Ryan Schrout.
I'm Jeremy Hellstrom.
I'm Josh Walrath.
And I'm Alan Malventano.
It's after all of our listener complaints about your throat clearing, you just had to bring it up right here at the beginning, didn't you?
Well, you got to get it out of the way.
So, based on that amount of throat clearing, we should be good to go for the remainder of the episode, and should be clear. And we've got a lot of crap to talk about this week. Like, how many bullet points are usually on our show notes here?
15, 14.
Yeah, we're up to like 30, 35. That's not even kind of like the sub points that I created, is it? So yeah, there's a lot of crap here. We can see part of the show notes, half of the show notes at the very least, the blank half. Actually, we're going to, I was going to remind you about the survey that we had going on for prizes, but that actually technically ends by the time this is posted. If you're watching this live and you haven't entered, you can go to the website and search for PC Perspective Survey, and you can take a survey. It will enter you to win prizes like a Corsair case, an OCZ SSD, and a Gigabyte Z77 motherboard. Other than that, we'll have more contests later, so we'll go ahead and move past that. It's Computex week. Now, this is actually the first year in more than a decade that I haven't been in Taiwan during Computex. This is usually where it's 9 in the morning and I'm up and I'm recording the show. Instead, it's 9 in the evening and I'm still in America, so things are going to be a little bit different. Hopefully, the internet connection will be a little bit more reliable. No promises. I'm still on Time Warner Cable. It's like being in a foreign country. So we'll go from there. But we do have a lot of stuff to touch on. So what we are going to do is be somewhat brief with all of our discussions today because there are so many items to get to. If you hear something, you hear us mention something, definitely go to pcpro.com/podcast and go into the show notes, and we have links to all the stories we are talking about today. So if you want a little bit more detail on something that we mentioned, maybe briefly in passing, go there and check out all the news posts that we've done with that as well. So let's start on the reviews. The first thing we're going to talk about is with Josh.
Me.
This is actually a little bit ironic that I went through that whole thing about being brief, and then we're going to start with Josh. Talking about reviews, you just posted today, actually, an article that looks at an MSI Radeon 7950 card. So give us a little bit of rundown on that.
I was going to try to talk really fast like an auctioneer, but it just didn't happen.
Micro Machines guy?
Anyway, MSI, they make video cards. They make some pretty decent video cards. I've reviewed one or two here in the past couple of years. And today they allowed me to take a look at the MSI R7850 Twin Frozer 3 DG50C. Did you get all that?
Perfect. Yeah, no, I got it.
Okay. Anyway, it's a Twin Frozer 3 based card. Twin Frozer 3 was introduced last year with some of their Lightning editions, and it slowly made its way into their other models. This is basically a reference 7950 PCB, but they were able to slap a Twin Frozer 3 on there, and it allows much, much better cooling, and they do have slightly better components on there. So it's a good board altogether. It keeps really, really cool. I think at like idle, it's 37 degrees. And at full load, it reached maybe like 57 degrees centigrade, Celsius, okay, whatever you want to call it. And that's pretty darn cool for a modern GPU, especially reference ones that go up to about 95 degrees Celsius. So this is a nice change to have one so cool. You're still able to increase the voltage on the GPU. So I was able to kind of pop that up a little bit. I got it up to 1100 megahertz core, which makes it a pretty quick board. And even though it's based on the 7950, which is a slightly disabled 7970, I think it's got four compute units that are disabled. It's a fast-moving board. It's faster than last generation's GTX 580. The one I compared it against was a heavily overclocked GTX 580. The N580 GTX Extreme Edition had 3 gigs of RAM, all that other crap. so this is It was a good board. It performed well. The Catalyst 12.6 drivers fixed a lot of issues with the 7000 series, namely when your monitors went to sleep, the GPU wouldn't wake back up again, and so you had to hard reset your system. And that was kind of introduced with the Cat 12.4s. But anyway, gameplay was really nice. It's got 3 gigs of frame buffer in there. It can handle pretty much any game out there at decent resolutions. If you really still want to do like Eyefinity, I would recommend getting a second one of these. It'll still run a lot of older games fine at those Eyefinity resolutions, but it starts to slow down after a bit, and you start getting these newer games like Dirt 3 Showdown, and even older ones like Metro. You're just not going to be able to play them on Eyefinity without more than one of them. So the only problem that I really saw with these is that stock price is $399. Sure, you get a nicer cooler, but at that same price, you can get a stock GTX 670, which is going to be faster than this card. Now, right. MSI and AMD are sweetening the pot a little bit by having a $20 mail-in rebate, so it takes it down to $379. And also, they're including $99 worth of games, namely Dirt Showdown, Deus Ex, Human Revolution, and the Missing Link DLC. And then I think, isn't Nexuiz, whatever you want to call it, isn't it free to play?
Yeah. Anyway? I honestly don't know. Jeremy, it is?
I think it is.
I'm but pretty anyway, sure it is.
They include that, and you may get a little something extra. But you get about $99 worth of games for this. So it kind of knocks the price down to $281 or something like that, if you can do higher math. 280, yeah. Whatever. But anyway, so it's it's a good board if you want those extras. I think that AMD and their partners still need to lower the prices on these a little bit. But otherwise, in terms of quality, how well it runs, it's a good product. And for $379, I can get past that. It's not a bad price for it. Now, what is kind of funny is that price then eclipses the overclocked HD 7870s, which are around that same price. And this still performs better than those overclocked products. And you're going to get a whole lot more value out of these as they go on. The other one of the bad thing that annoys me to no end, and you can see it in that picture, it's got one DVI output. It's a single dual link. Otherwise, you're stuck with HDMI and two display ports. And I don't know, Ryan, how many monitors do you know of that feature native display port?
Not a lot.
That many. So yeah, it's kind of
they're also inexpensive.
So now, but if you're only going to use two monitors, you can use a DVI and then a passive display port to
DVI. But that's only good up to 1920 by 1200. So if you've got two 30-inch monitors or one of those new 27-inch monitors that people are going nuts
about. That's true.
Then you're going to be out of luck and you have to buy a $100 adapter to it's the powered active DisplayPort to DVI. So
yeah,
it's unfortunate, but that's about the only real weakness other than price.
Now somebody in the chat room wanted us to point out that the fans are above the level of the cooler. Is that right? Like they stick out a little bit. And he said that he'd had problems with his 570s that were on that same design where it would cause the fans to maybe touch the back of a card if you were doing a dual GPU setup.
Might. I mean, it's pretty close there. I've put these in Crossfire. Well, not this one in particular, but some of the earlier ones that have about the same, type design. And usually I had a space in between the two cards, notice that. But yeah, I guess that he is right. If you were right next to each other, you could have some serious clearance issues.
We had an issue even with an interesting Crossfire problem in an episode of Twitch where somebody was complaining that they had overclocked models from like Power Color or somebody, I can't remember. And the fans, the shroud, I guess, around the fans was thick enough so that when they were next to each other, not only did they kind of almost have direct contact, but it made the 100 millimeter, like you couldn't use the 100 millimeter Crossfire cable, like the standard Crossfire cable. So he was trying to find a longer version of it. So interesting stuff to take note there. So full review up at the site today. So
look, super pipes.
Super pipes. What else went up this week? Steve makes his triumphant return back to PC Perspective after doing military training of some kind, and posts a review of the Asus Sabertooth X79 motherboard. This is part of the Tough series from Asus. This is it has kind of the military class components. It isn't quite like what was the first one that came out with it? Like a P55, I think, that had like the shell over the entirety of the PCB, and that the new Z77 version of the Sabertooth has like the shell that kind of covers everything except the PCI Express slots and the DIMM slots. This doesn't have that. It's not to that extreme, but it definitely has some higher end components and that kind of stuff. So if you are on the look for a stock of 2011 Sandy Bridge E motherboard, you can check out his review there. I think we've got a half dozen or so X79 reviews up there. He came away really impressed with the board, does have support for three-way Crossfire and SLI, got our gold award. So check out that review. What else we have? The kind of long-awaited review of the DV Nation Ramrod PC.
Ramrod. Josh's
favorite named
Team PC. Ramrod.
We already went through like the overview and the pictures of it, I think, a couple of weeks ago when we posted a little preview of it. If you go to the second page of the review, you'll see kind of what the system is really known for. That's its performance benchmarks. And Alan, feel free to chime in here at any point. But they're using a Primo RAM disk software. So the system ships with 64 gigs of memory. So the maximum amount of memory that you can install on a consumer desktop PC today. This is a Sandy Bridge E-based rig. 64 gigs. They reserve 42 gigabytes of that memory as a RAM disk. So it shows up as a drive letter when you turn on Windows. Shows up as the R partition for RAM disk. Get it? How clever they were. Which leaves 22 gigs for other uses that they have. They use for separate caching of their other drives, their PCI Express SSD and their RAID 0 hybrid SSDs or hybrid hard drives. 6 gigs for each of that. And then I think that leaves you 8 or 10 gigs of just regular system memory left at that point. It's interesting because the RAM disk configuration, there's two options. There's you can run it as a SCSI disk or you can run it as a direct IO. And SCSI disk, it works like a real physical disk. When you open up computer management, you can see it in there as if it were a hard drive in your system. When you run it as direct IO, it's logical only. It's faster, but not all applications will be able to see it in that way, or not all benchmarks were able to see it for sure. So we had to kind of go back and forth in which mode we left it in for actual testing. The only benchmark that could see it in both modes was Crystal Disk. And we saw speeds go from 7 gigs per second down to 5.2 gigs per second, going from the direct IO faster mode to the SCSI mode. And that, kind of, it actually got even more dramatically different when we got into 4K reads and writes and that kind of stuff, going from 1.6 gigs down to 670 megabytes. Alan, what do you know what that is, the difference there between the SCSI and the direct IO, like what the direct IO version of that would actually be doing?
The SCSI device just shows up as a native. Basically, there's more overhead to it for the driver, because the driver is emulating. It's taking flash memory and it's just emulating as if it was a SCSI disk. So a SCSI device is just the same kind of thing as if you had a RAID controller driver, that sort of deal, where it just shows up as a Windows SCSI device.
Yeah. Right?
The direct IO stuff, I'm not sure, if it didn't get a drive letter, then, or did it?
It does, it does get a drive letter even in direct IO mode. It says in the software, the direct IO RAM disk is designed for faster access, uses a direct IO method to access data, and consequently reduces a lot of the internal system transfer and process time, which in turn shows better performance. The cost of performance improvement is that the direct IO RAM disk is treated as a logical disk by the Windows OS and may not be seen by some third-party disk management utilities.
Oh, okay. So in other words, you can't do raw benches to it. In other words, you can't do benchmarks to it where the benchmark has to see just the drive by itself without a partition. In other words, right? So it has to be logical. In other words, just you send it a file and then it sort of intercepts that call and it just does whatever it needs to do to put the file on the disk, but it doesn't let the OS know all that information, exactly where is the file located, that sort of thing. So, yeah.
It's handling all that in the back. Okay.
Yeah, it just handles it a different way. So it's able to do it faster, but not everything is compatible with it. It's really, you just have to stick with just direct kind of like file access. You can't really do any kind of benchmark, you know, silliness.
Makes sense. Yeah, they said in their documentation that it should work with basically any regular program, but benchmarks were a little bit hit or miss. We have some other tests in there. We did ASSSD, HDTAC, and ADDO, and you can see those. Now, the key for this system with a RAM disk, you can use a RAM disk with any amount of memory that you have, and you can use it with any storage configuration you want in reality. The main problem with the RAM disk is that you have to read it and write it back to a permanent storage device every time you boot the system up. So, you know, obviously when you turn off your computer, the RAM information goes away. So you wouldn't want to install applications or have data there. So what it does is when you shut down your computer, it writes all of the data to a permanent storage location, a hard drive, for example. And then when you boot up the machine, it has to read all that data off of the hard drive and put it back into system memory, and then you get all the speed up. Now, one of the things that the Ramrod PC did is that they have a 480 gigabyte PCI Express SSD in there from OCZ, the Revo Drive 3X2, I think is what it is. So it's a 480 gig PCIe SSD, so that reading and writing back and forth is really fast, right? So 42 gigs is not that long for the SSD to copy back into memory when you reboot. And apparently the software is smart enough to only copy back to the SSD files that change, right? So it's able to keep track of that kind of stuff. So it doesn't necessarily have to write every time you shut down all of the data, just the portions that change, which is pretty nice. So, I mean, in terms of storage performance, it's the fastest storage performance PC you could buy, essentially, you know, kind of from a random system builder. And they also, I mean, it's a Sandy Bridge G system. This one came with a Radeon HD 6990 dual GPU graphics card, but they offer them with 680s and 690s as well. So, you know, this can be aimed at gamers, although I think it's overkill for gamers. If you have very specific use cases for the need for this super high-end type of storage, you should definitely check this out. There's a lot more info in the review if you want to see, because they also use Supercache to create like a 6 gig or an 8 gig RAM cache for the PCIe SSD and for your standard hard drive as well. And it kind of, walk you through a little bit of what that does. And obviously, you know, running that obviously messes up some benchmarks as well. So we had to turn off and disable some of that for some of our testing. But it is an expensive system, as you would imagine, with a 480 gig PCI Express SSD. It's $5,000 plus machine. Although they do offer some configurations that are like $29.99 and that kind of stuff. So, interesting, unique system from a system builder as opposed to ones that just have, you know, high-end overclock CPUs and that kind of stuff.
And they let you keep that, right, for your new video editing.
It's already on its way back to San Antonio, actually. So, sorry, Ken. Sorry. Yeah, I sent it to Rod. I mean, it got lost in FedEx. It's weird. what else went up? Oh, Matt posted a review of a Samsung Series 5 Chromebook. Chromebook's out again, a second revision. He actually became away much more impressed with this version of the Chromebook, this iteration of the operating system as well as the hardware than the last one. So check that out if you're interested in there. And again, because of time constraints, we're going to go through quickly. And he also posted up the Intel Ultrabook Ivy Bridge reference review, which essentially is the kind of, it was the launch of the dual core ULV Ultrabooks, or I'm sorry, the dual core ULV Ivy Bridge processors. So this was, you know, they sent us like an Ultrabook reference platform, giving you an idea of the performance, the battery life, the type of reference designs, the type of platform considerations that you get with Ivy Bridge. CPU performance was great. I think he was very surprised at how much lower the GPU performance was on it, even though it also claims to have HD 4000 graphics, just like the super high-end Ivy Bridge processors did, both on the mobile and the desktop front. If you look at the 3D performance and game benchmarks on that, the difference between the HD 4000 on the Core i7 processor and the HD 4000 on the Core i5, on the i5 processor is pretty dramatic. Like, what's one of these examples here? In Dawn of War 2, for example, the average goes from 46 to 27 frames per second. Diablo 3 was pretty even across both of them. Skyrim drops from 21.5 to 17. Battlefield 3 drops from 25 to 17. So even though they're both labeled HD 4000, they don't get up to the same clock speeds because of the ULV nature of the
spit it out, Ryan.
Ultrabook processors. I'm trying so bad.
Ultrabook.
Ultrabook.
Because you know you've had that shoved down your throat for the past year.
Yeah,
just trying to get out.
You know, if you are one of those people that maybe doesn't like the idea of an ultrabook, go read Matt's review. He's not real keen on the idea of ultrabooks just in general. I am more keen on the ideas of ultrabooks than he is. We, you know, have discussions back and forth about it, but I think it's good because I can argue for it, he can argue against it, and we come to a common ground. But if you're interested in that type of stuff, go read his review of the Ivy Bridge Core i5-3427U because there's a lot of that kind of back and forth discussion included in there. So worth noting for sure. Okay, we're going to take a quick advertising break here to thank MSI for their support of PC Perspective, and then we'll come right back and jump into just news of stuff. Just lots of news stuff. Hey guys, it's Ryan here again. We don't actually have an advertisement to play for you, but since we put it in the spot in the audio podcast when we were recording it, I figured I'd fill it with something else. Have you checked out pcper.com/Computex? That's where you can get all of the latest news from the Computex show, as well as catch up on some of the details maybe we left out during our discussion today. Back to you, Ryan. So, okay, item number 13, AMD loses monthly Catalyst updates. The idea here is simple. Catalyst 12.6 meant that it was released in June. Catalyst 12.4 meant it was released in April. And Catalyst 11.8 meant that it was released in August. That they're getting away from that. They used to release a new driver every 25th of every month, I guess. And they're changing it. They're not doing that anymore. They're going more to what I'm considering an NVIDIA-like schedule. They call it a what do they call it? They have some fancy.
Dynamic?
Yeah, yeah. That's a great
dynamic
euphemism
release
for
gradual.
Whenever the hell we want to, right? So they're going to be more, you know, release a driver for a new game. Release a driver if they find a bunch of things to fix. My kind of worry here is that we will see, you know, drivers maybe only every two or three months instead of once a month.
I'm actually kind of happy about this. I'm going to interject.
Go for it. Because
if you think about it, I almost cleared my throat, but I abstained.
Oof, good job.
Thanks. If you think about it, that the process they have to go through to get WHQL certification is a pain in the butt. You have to send it out, they send it back, you work on it, you send it out, they send it back. And it takes up a lot of time. Mm-hmm. Time that you could be spent actually fixing problems and doing good work with your drivers. Instead, you're in this bureaucratic nightmare with Microsoft trying to get the WHQL certification every month. Now, at least with doing this,
and that's the only reason
they can actually... Pardon?
And that's the only reason they're doing it is because the new month is coming up, so we have to release
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Is this going to work? So we don't know. It might break everything, but we got to get it. We got to get it.
Got to do it. Yeah. So this at least allows them to kind of plan it out, get some major revisions in there, make some major changes if needed be, and then get them out quicker instead of having to say, hey, I'm still working on, you know, Catalyst 12.8, and even though we've got these things that we're trying to get to, and we may be able to address them in 12.10. I've still got to wait for Microsoft to get back to me on this part, and I have to, you know, rebuild it and send it back to them. And instead, they're just going to work on stuff, and whenever they feel the need to, they'll send it out for WHQL. Otherwise, they'll do beta form like they're doing now. So I think this is a positive thing. Dynamic, okay. Sure. Organic, maybe a better description. Instead of being
I just hope it gets rid of all the confusion they had when they would have like three different versions of a driver come out in the same week or 2 week time frame, and you would never know which one was the one you should be using. That really irked me when they were doing that with, you know, when the Battlefield release was coming out and Skyrim was coming out and all that kind of stuff. We had a lot of issues with that. So they're changing it, and it's one of those things. Josh thinks it'll be a good thing. I'm hoping it'll be a good thing, and we'll just kind of see over the long run. Okay.
Hey, Jeremy thinks it's a good thing, too, and that's the only thing I probably have ever agreed with him on, except scotch whiskey.
Like beer.
Beers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wetware, yes. Hardware, not always.
Ultrabooks. I don't know if you guys have heard of these things. Apparently, some people are making Ultrabooks. Surprisingly, Gigabyte launches Ultra Portable Notebook lineup. And I believe, which was the one here that it was one that was like made out of carbon fiber? Do you remember which one that was, Jeremy?
Oh, no, that was...
Oh, the X11.
Yeah.
X11. Carbon, completely, and like actual carbon fiber, not carbon fiber look-alike. It's actual carbon fiber. They say it's an ultra-lightweight 11.6-inch notebook at 975 grams. Could somebody convert that to real numbers for me? What's...
That is real
975 grams. No. And 0.3 centimeters. That's, man, that's 30 millimeters.
It's about 2 pounds.
Can do that. Okay. All right. What else has it got here? It's built using a woven diamond technique that resulted in it being lightweight, maintaining rigidity. That's the whole idea of carbon fiber. 16 by 9 LED backlit display, blah, blah, blah. The problem with this release really for me is I have no expectations that Gigabyte is going to release any of this in the US. Have we seen Gigabyte laptops for sale in the US? I don't think I ever have.
No, I've seen Asus MSI, but no Gigabyte.
No.
And even MSI is getting less recognizable. Out. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it's harder for these Taiwanese companies to come into the U.S. and start marketing and pushing laptops and stuff. And Asus is done that a lot. But
give them time, and they'll be selling sleek books. So,
yeah,
I would expect.
So, Gigabyte is also one of the few to have announced a ultrabook with a discrete GPU in it. They're actually using, which one is it? The GT650M, GeForce GT650M. So that's actually Kepler based. That's on there. The Gigabyte U2442. So an ultrabook with a 1600 by 900 resolution with the discrete graphics is pretty nice. And does it say a price on here? I don't see one. So
the X11?
$1 with diamond carbon.
Yeah. Most of them are about between $1,000 to $1,300, with the U2442 being the low price one at about $7. So it's the only one that actually qualifies as an ultrabook.
Right. Yeah. There you go. Gigabyte has ultrabooks. Who else has ultrabooks? Oh, Acer has the Aspire S7. Was this the one that had the 180-degree hinges?
For whatever reason.
I don't understand that. Why would you ever want to lay your screen flat on the table?
You don't.
Is it so you could use it as a touchscreen? Because it's a touchscreen, right? So maybe you can
use it as a touchscreen. Yeah, you lay the keyboard flat on the table.
Right, but
it cost too much to get a hinge that went 360 so that you could turn it into a double-sided device. It's the only thing I got.
Oh, right. Like, wait. So this is 180,
you just pretend you work for Wayland Corp. And, correct. You know, that's how you do your computing. You do the...
I'm just trying to figure out a use case for this, and I can't think of anything.
So I guess what they're going for is you want to use it like a tablet that's just laying on the table in front of you, so you spin it around upside down and the keyboard's up near the top. That's kind of weird.
You get the keyboard out of the way because it's just interfering anyways.
It doesn't make any sense. They're good looking devices otherwise. They have an Aspire S7 11-inch and a 13.3-inch. Touch enabled and with 180-degree hinge. Yeah. No idea on pricing yet. Backlit keyboard and a glass lid on the 13-inch model, so it'd have a glass kind of back like the Spectre, the HP Spectre maybe. So Acer announces those early in the week. They also announced Iconia tablets. The main focuses at Computex in general are Windows 8 tablets, Windows 8 touch enabled laptops, convertible tablets and laptops and that kind of stuff. If you look up the Acer Iconia Windows 8 tablets, you can see video there. Tim did a good post on that. Asus never one to let a Computex go by without just announcing a ton of crazy crap. The Tai Chi convertible notebook and tablet with dual displays. Now, this is more in the line of what we were thinking just a second ago the Acer should do, right? So this is an ultrabook. It's a Windows 8 kind of touch-enabled ultrabook, but when you close the display on the keyboard, like when you close a laptop like you would normally see it, on the top of the On the back or the top of the screen is another display that is touch-enabled, so then you can use Windows 8 as a tablet, right? So this one kind of seems more useful, except for the whole idea of having a display facing away from you when you're using it in keyboard mode. Sounds a little bit...
What if you're playing Battleship and it's touchscreen enabled?
So then you can have your friend on the other side and you on this side using... Yeah, you could do that. I could see at least one application of being able to do that. They always use the use case of, you know, I could be working at a desk and Alan is sitting on the other side of me and I say, hey, Alan, check this out. And I just turn on the other screen and he can see what I'm doing on the other side. That's great, except I very rarely use my laptop with a 90-degree angle on my laptop so that we both have a 90-degree angle looking at it on either side. I tend to have it folded back a little, which means Alan would have to sneak on down to...
Don't go there.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Alan would have to get under the table.
Yeah, you don't want to look at what Ryan's looking at in the first place.
Oh, no, you do.
The position I'm worried about.
Oh, you do. So
I'm just looking at your screen, Ryan.
Yeah, sure. I got you. Tai Chi is interesting. They have the Transformer book, which is exactly what you would expect. Actually, maybe not, because the Transformer has been an Android device up through now. The Transformer Prime, Transformer Infinity, is that one too? I think it is. That's one with the 1920 by 1200 screen that I don't think is even out yet. So the Transformer book is an ultrabook with a detachable tablet, obviously using Windows 8. But I kind of like this idea a little bit better, right? So it's an ultrabook normally, and then when you disconnect the top, you're using a Windows 8 tablet at that point. And apparently, according to the post over at Engadget, because you have all the computing power in the screen, remember that, Josh? All the it's light.
Yeah, the hot parts.
I remember that.
Thanks for reminding me.
No problem. But the interesting part is that the discrete GPU is apparently going to be in the keyboard dock. So, when you actually dock it, not only do you get extra battery life and the functionality of a keyboard and a touchpad, but you get a little bit more processing power in the discrete GPU as well, which is interesting. I find this maybe the most compelling of all the kind of unique solutions I've seen so far. For kind of convertible tablets and that kind of deal. So
don't you find it kind of a waste, though? I mean, why can't you just, you know, use the regular hinge? Well, I guess you can't since it's a freaking tablet, but I just think it's kind of a waste to have two screens on one device like that.
Well, now, see, the Transformer book doesn't have two screens. It's one screen.
Oh, okay. Sorry, we went on to another thing and I got confused.
Yeah, switched.
That happens a lot.
We moved on. The Transformer book. We talked about the Tai Chi, which is kind of like what they would consider a prototype, like a idea, like just a prototype they're trying out. The Transformer book seems like a product they're actually going to, you know, sell and release fairly soon. Now, Josh, we're going to move on to a third product in the ASUS.
Okay, lineup. I'm ready for that. Do you need me to clear my throat?
Maybe on mute.
Is that code for me to continue?
Yeah, so ASUS also showed off tablets. This is funny. So they're calling the Tablet 810 a tablet. It is a 11.6-inch screen, Intel Atom-powered tablet with a keyboard dock, whereas the one we were just talking about was actually an ultrabook with a detachable screen. The difference between the two is really just what processor is powering them. To me, they're both the same, but obviously they're not branding an ultrabook as an Atom-powered device. So the ASUS A10 is a Atom-powered Clover Trail. Is that the right? Yeah, Clover Trail-based. So don't expect huge amounts of performance. Windows 8, blah, blah, blah. And then the Tablet 600 is actually a Tegra 3 Windows 8 RT power device. And I think it was the first Windows 8 RT. Is it Windows 8 RT or just Windows RT?
As far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think it is the Windows RT.
Wart. Yeah.
So it was the first Tegra 3 Wart device shown publicly. So they had that going for them. So it's Tegra 3, 2 gigs of memory, 1366 by 768 resolution screens. So fairly kind of low res, but we're talking about a 10-inch display.
RT stands for regular tranny.
I think that's accurate, actually.
Real topical?
Yeah, no, I think that's correct. I looked it up on Wikipedia just now. I think that's correct. Main Gear announced a Pulse 11 ultra portable gaming notebook. They are not the only company that's going to sell this. The only problem is it's an 11 inch 1366 by 768 screen. That right off kind of in terms of a gaming notebook, maybe not that amazing because of that resolution. I thought we'd kind of move past that. But it does have, it's notable in its performance, right? It's got a Core i7-3612 processor in it, but it's got an NVIDIA GT650M Kepler graphics as well with 2 gig frame buffer on it. So it's pretty interesting to see from Main Gear. I mean, it's an ODM based design, right? You're gonna be able to buy this from several different vendors. Main Gear happens to be the first one out the door with it. I don't know if they're actually taking orders with it or not. It's supposed to have good audio through THX branded stuff, starting at $999 for the base model and going up from there. So if you've been interested in the Alienware M11X. But don't want to spend Alienware type of money, you can check out these kind of ODM branded machines like this Main Gear rig that are 11 inches, similar size, have cool gaming specifications, but not as expensive. Alan, we also saw a SanDisk PCIe SSD of some kind of launch.
Hey, wait, Alan's here?
Yep.
No.
Go ahead. Tell me about this SanDisk.
All right, so the SanDisk Lightning, SanDisk in the past has already had Lightning series drives, but they've been 2.5 inch, you know, enterprise class type devices. So, you know, regular style SSDs that you and I and everybody are used to seeing. Now they have a Lightning series that's PCI Express. So it looks very similar to the Intel SSD 910 that we already looked at. PCI Express, half-height form factor, except this one's a little simpler, whereas the Intel has, you know, a bunch of controllers and a RAID chip and everything else. It seems like they tied most of that all together. So the chip count is drastically reduced, and it doesn't pack as much of a punch. It doesn't do the same 2 gigabytes per second you can get out of the Intel 910. But on the flip side, it's much cheaper, and it's also bootable, which the 910 is not because they left out the boot ROM for some reason. So SanDisk left the boot ROM in. Good. Good on people trying to have a workstation machine that just has this as the only storage device in it.
Do you want that as the only storage thing? I mean, I guess 400 gigs is fine, but...
Yeah, if you just got a workstation machine that's doing something like AutoCAD, right? I mean, you want the storage to be fast, but you don't necessarily need a whole boatload of it. Right, they also make this in a 200 gig model, even so you can even go that route. But yeah, I think the bootable thing is significant when it comes to like the end of the market where you're just sticking it in a workstation machine. You want a really really high end workstation machine, that sort of thing. You just want one of these in there, then you can just boot off of it. As opposed to if you try to do the same trick with either an IO drive or an Intel 910. Then you have to go buy another SSD just to install the OS on, which in my opinion it's just kind of corny, right? You already have this really expensive, you know, $1,000+ solid state drive in there, and then you can't just boot. You know, Fusion IO, their excuse makes sense because their architecture, the driver does most of the grunt work, right? Whereas the Intel 910 series, they used an off-the-shelf LSI controller, which in the same form comes on its own card and is bootable. So, you know, it's almost like they pulled that part out just because they didn't feel like supporting it. So that just, you know, it was kind of like a crappy move, in my opinion, on their part. But this
way
one,
to go.
SanDisk drive, you know, but yeah, good, bootable. I'm sure they'll have sales for those exact kind of people that want to put them in the workstation machine.
We noticed
Ryan.
Yeah.
Show us how strong you are by finding that straw and saying, I'm going to kick your butt.
No.
Because guys look really, really intimidating.
On the stream, only my face is being shown, apparently. So sure. You guys listen to Al talk while I stared at you and other things. So there you go. That's kind of weird. I don't really get it.
don't know.
I tried to mount along a little while. Well, it's switching fine for us, but if you look at the actual stream, it wasn't changing it at one point. So apparently it will be fixed now, I'm told.
Gotcha. Sorry.
That's all right. So
recording won't be like that. Sorry. Whoever out there, anybody out there, I guess.
Gotcha.
Excuse me. I'll quit talking.
The voice from above, everybody.
Do we get a refund for the, you know, 2 minutes that we wasted looking at Ryan?
Well, you've wasted way more than that.
Yeah, anyway, let's move on, shall we?
Conglomerate. Let's talk about the A85 motherboards. Did you know anything about these, Josh? Because I was surprised really to see them since we had seen... No, I take that back. I'm not really surprised we saw them, but apparently the Trinity kind of desktop APUs were pushed back a little bit. But we did see motherboards from ECS, ASRock, and a lot from MSI showing apparently a whole new chipset, the A85 chipset to support the new FM2 socket. Do you know anything about these other than what I just said?
I know a few things. Basically, A85 is very, very similar to A75. In fact, some of the A85 boards are based on the A75 silicon. That being said, they're really starting to ramp up for Trinity. Right now, as far as I understand and can see and kind of read around, AMD is selling every Trinity CPU they can produce, and they're really producing as many as they can. The majority of these are all going to notebooks and the upcoming ultra
portables?
Whatever the hell they what?
Oh, we're just gonna go with ultra portables. I don't know.
Ultra portables, the 17-watt ones. The interesting thing about Trinity is they showed it off early last year. I mean, well, I think in Computex of last year, they showed off some of the first working silicon of Trinity. And there was a lot of discussion that they would, in fact, release it around a January time frame. Well, January came and went, and finally we saw these products in, what, late March, early April, mid-April? I think mid-April is when the launch was. And they've been slowly becoming available, and a lot of guys have announced design wins for them. And they're going to try to put them out into desktop as soon as they could. Well, in between them selling as many as they can to the portable guys, I think there's also a lot of Llano chips still on the market. And AMD is really hoping to clear that out in the retail space and some of the OEM space. And so they are only going to be offering Trinity to certain select OEM partners on the desktop. But until that time, we're looking at ECS, ASRock, MSI, that they're releasing their motherboards that are going to be all socket FM2. And some of these could be finding their ways into OEM machines. But a lot of validation apparently is going on behind the scenes. I know talked to some guys from ASUS, and that's their primary goal on the AMD side is getting Trinity up and running as well as they can on the desktop. And because... while Bulldozer was not really a success, it kept AMD, treading water. And the issues that Bulldozer has were primarily fixed by Trinity and the Piledriver core. Now, the biggest issues were, of course, energy and power consumption, and then a little bit on performance. So they improved performance per clock, but the biggest thing is that the power consumption is a whole lot better for these. We can see we've got pretty functional 17-watt Trinity. They go as high as 35 watts for the mobile. So of course we're doing a lot better there than we were in previous generations. So it's we could go on for quite a while about Trinity, Piledriver, Vishera,
we'll have time
all those
soon.
Things. But let's not do that. But yeah, I mean, it's not surprising to see these out because the chipset is well known. They're just designing new things around it, and they expect a lot more volume from these parts than they have seen in a while from AMD, which is good for everybody.
But only ECS released one with two PCI Express 16x ports.
No, MSI has one.
Oh, do they? Okay, almost all the other ones I saw were just a single one.
Yeah, no, MSI has one of the E65, the A85-E65, I think is what it's called.
Based on the pictures that we got, MSI had a pretty big A85 presence there. That's 4 or 5 different motherboards for it. So
Yeah. So that's good.
Other news that came this week, not necessarily Computex news, but Asus would like to, quote, clear the air on who's the fastest of them all. Jeremy, what were they disputing here?
Well, it was a post that we'd put up not too long ago where it was Gigabyte claiming that they did some world-class overclocking, beating 7 gigahertz on a Z77X UD3H, and of course it was an i7-3770 that they overclocked. Well, Asus would like to point out that a while back, they beat them. A 7.03 from Gigabyte is not quite as fast as a 7.07 from the Maximus 5 Gene. The memory overclocking, perhaps, they did not really do that. But because Gigabyte managed to get DDR3 up to 3.28 gigahertz, which is completely and utterly disgusting. But as far as the actual record stands, it is Asus and the Maximus 5 Gene, that little tiny mini IT or micro ATX board that is right now the king of the LN overcooling, or yes, liquid nitrogen overcooling, overclocking, over everything competitions.
I want you to say that I'm disappointed that I clicked the SmackDown tag that you put on this news post, Jeremy, and this is the only post that has been tagged SmackDown on our site. So keep that tag in mind as we come across different news things. There's also a lot of rumors that at WWDC, I don't know what their event is called, the Apple event in San Francisco. I think that's what it is. At that event with Dick Clark, Apple is apparently going to be announcing new MacBooks refreshes, MacBook Air refreshes, maybe Mac Pro refreshes. Nobody's really sure exactly what it is, but the prevailing rumor is that something is going to happen with a Retina display, which is a dumb term, but I'm going to say like an ultra high res display on a laptop. And some people are saying it's going to happen across the whole lineup of notebooks, from the Ultrabook MacBook Airs all the way up to the MacBook Pros, maybe even a new MacBook Pro 17-inch model. And we're talking about resolutions. People are quoting at as high as 2880 by 1400 something, but more than likely, 2560 by 1440 is probably what we're going to see there. So that's, if that's the case, that's pretty impressive, right? I would really like to see increases in this area. Display technology, it used to be hard drives. Hard drives were the one area in a computer where you could say, this really needs to be updated. And then SSDs came around over the last couple of years. We've really seen those take off. And now I think it needs to be displays. Displays really need to take off. And I don't have anything against Apple, but it kind of sucks that they're going to be the ones to do it first again and kind of push things along. But hopefully that will...
Hey, they're the only people who can afford to do that.
Yeah.
Well, the Apple only people drives that have, the price down because they charge so damn much for their product. So.
Well, what they had the capability to... Because they only sell 4 products, right, at a time, with very minor configurations, they have the ability to buy up so much inventory from these manufacturers, they can get it at a lower price. Whereas if you're, one of the 24 laptop vendors in the country for Windows PCs, you can't do that necessarily. So either way, they get credit for doing this if they ended up doing it. So we'll have to see it. I think is that coming up this week? I think that's actually coming up this week. So hopefully we'll know soon on that.
And maybe they'll explain the Thunderbolt display.
What about it? I can explain it to you. It's expensive.
Lightning bolt.
I almost bought one. I was at a Fry's down here in Austin. I was going to buy a Thunderbolt display until I found out that you cannot use a Thunderbolt display
this year.
Well, yeah, you can't use a Thunderbolt display on a mini DisplayPort output out of a graphics card. Nope. I don't understand it. Like, I understand. I mean, it just seems so stupid. Like, how much more logic can there be if Thunderbolt already has to, one of the requirements is the specification is that it has to be able to pass through mini DP. So I can hook a mini DP monitor up to a Thunderbolt connection or on a Thunderbolt pass-through on a device. But you can't take a Thunderbolt display, which Apple makes the only one, and plug it into a mini DP output on an AMD or an NVIDIA graphics card. And I find that pretty much
horse crap.
That's
what I've been hearing too, which just seems weird.
It seems stupid, and I'm not going to pay $1,000 for a monitor that I can use with exactly one laptop, one set of laptops, and two motherboards. Right? That's dumb. Gigabyte showed off an X79S motherboard. Does anybody know exactly what this is?
Server style, isn't it? It comes with like 14 stinking SATA ports.
Yep.
8 of them are SAS. And it's essentially a server board. If you need that kind of storage, which Alan would probably use, he would do bad things to it at night. Ooh, show me those ports.
It has a PCI. It has a legacy PCI slot on it.
That's good.
Is it?
For server class boards, yeah. Because there's the occasional card that's PCI that they still need to be able to stick in.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So this motherboard will support the Xeon processors, right? In addition to the regular CPUs. Is that what I guess the difference there is? Because there's really no chipset called the X79S, right? Am I making this up? Or I believe that to be the case.
Yeah. And they must have tacked on some other SATA controller, right?
Well, I think so. They definitely did.
Yes, because the X79 does not support 14 SATA drive.
No. Comes close. No, it does not. But not quite.
See, look at all those SATA ports at the back of that stinking thing.
I wonder if
SATA ports as far as the eye can see.
Maybe SAS controllers on here, too?
They could be cheating and using the SAS controllers.
Although they are using a SAS controller. It's a SATA 6 SAS controller. If you put in a single, it'll support the SATA drives. But as soon as you do that, it'll go down to SATA 3G. So whatever information you can glean from that, that's what chip they're using.
I don't know of a 6-gigabit SAS chip that steps back to 3 on SATA.
Well, I think all SAS chips do.
No.
I think it steps back to SATA, doesn't it? It's not really a SAS.
It goes from SAS, SAS, 6 gigabit. When you plug in a single, it goes to SATA 3G.
Yeah, like it totally switches.
It says that there are 8 SAS connectors and 6 SATA ports. So I'm guessing the 6 are coming from the Intel chipset directly, and then they're using maybe an LSI controller for the SAS.
Yeah, that's probably an LSI controller.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah.
Interesting. Definitely. I mean, I'm not sure how much LGA 1511 is going on.
Yeah, definitely.
Definitely. Yeah. So that's a pretty sweet, probably pretty expensive motherboard. Speaking of LSI, though, they are showing off SandForce controllers running 19 and 20 nanometer flash at Computex 2.
Yes, and this is actually the same trick that they did. It wasn't a Computex last time. It was like a storage. It was IDF or something.
Sure.
Right? Wasn't it one of those? It was like a year and a half ago when they showed 25 nanometer. So, SandForce has a habit of trying to be the first guys to support, whatever the newest and smallest process flash memory is. So the 20 nanometer stuff has been around for a while, but it's basically been tailored to embedded stuff and it hasn't really been shipping in volume. And here we go. It's probably on the horizon coming up here now. Intel's been making it for a while, and so is Toshiba. They've been making 19 nanometer just because they wanted to get like one more nanometer out of it and say they could beat Intel or something.
It's probably like 19 and a half.
Yeah, it's a 19.998 or something. And yeah, this is 19 round down. Damn it. So it's not just these two types of flash memory, actually. The current SandForce architecture supports 6 different types, which I didn't even know that there were 6 different types. There's like mnemonics or the Hynix. They make stuff. Samsung, IMFT, Toshiba. Did I already say Samsung?
Maybe.
I don't know. Yeah, I guess that was
Lamb.
6, maybe. I don't know. Basically, all the types of flash memory out there are supported by this guy. So if you're an OEM and you want to use this kind of chip in there, that's, you know, that you might be have something driving you towards.
Is that the purpose for these demonstrations? Is like, hey, we're the first controller that's ready?
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
And
any speed improvements to expect from this?
It didn't look like it. Uses the same error correction levels, still 6 gigabit. Nothing else seemed different. I went all the way through their presentation. Really, the big selling point was, hey, look, this supports all these new types, which does require changes. You know, it does require some hardware changes, but not to like the core design of the chip. It's really just to the parts of the chip that interface with the flash itself.
So when do we expect Endurance to reach the levels of the more mature 25 nanometer stuff that we're seeing now?
So, yeah, the more mature 25 nanometer stuff that's out there, the really good stuff like the IMFT stuff, some of that is rated upwards of 30,000 cycles. Now, think back to 50 nanometer, and this is a while ago, right? This is like 4 years ago. For 50 nanometer, the guideline was SLC is 100K cycles and MLC is 10K cycles. So we went from between 50 down to 34, down to 25, and they've able to refine 25 to the point where, right now, when you get that, high endurance technology, all that other stuff, you know, all the bells and whistles kind of flash memory, which they basically cherry pick off their line. They're like, okay, this is the absolute, you know, these chips are coming out really good. Those are rated up to like 30K cycles. So who's to say which way it could go, right? I mean, 20 nanometer flash out of IMFT, they may very well be able to get at least to 10K, but, you know, maybe, you know, a year or two down the road from when they start making it, maybe even towards, you know, 15, 20, 30K. So, yeah, they're really able to make this stuff work for a very long time now. I mean, evidenced by not only did the Intel 910 series say this, but now the SanDisk Lightning series drive says the same thing. 5-year warranty, you can write the entire volume of the drive 10 times over for every day of the 5 years. So that's a lot of cycles, right?
I'm not sure that's enough for me.
Yeah, I know, right? I mean,
because your movie collection changes so dramatically.
I just delete it and re-download every time.
Yeah, you just got to re-download 800 gigabytes just 10 times a day. And
I don't see what the issue is there.
That's when you run defrag on your solid state drive just because you can.
Yeah.
That's, you know, I need to reach my 10 cycles per day. What do I do? A bunch of really bad things for your solid state drive? Yes, I'll do all those. Okay, good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there you go.
Corsair RAM fails constantly.
Yeah. You know, that's actually interesting. We got that question about that Ramrod PC. Is would the copying of that 42 gigs of data every time you shut down your machine to the PCI Express SSD cause problems with that? So even if you shut down your machine every night, which I think very few of us actually do, it's still not even going to come close to being a bother, right?
So did you actually do these shutdowns and startups and like time them by chance?
Yeah, I noticed. I noticed a difference, but it was fairly minimal. And because I wasn't changing the contents on the shutdown was almost, you know, kind of instantaneous.
Okay, so it doesn't just dump it to the SSD, like just when you're shutting down, right? It's like the stuff's basically already there, right? It keeps it in stack. The background or something?
My understanding is that it's not constantly writing it in the background, but it's keeping track of what's changed, and then it's only going to copy what has changed over in the background.
Well, that's good. So, during startup, you got to reread that whole 40-something gig off the SSD.
Correct. You have to read it off of it every time you start. Yeah. And it pauses there. And like I said, because it's a PCI Express SSD, reading 42 gigs off of that doesn't take very long. And probably, you know, a normal Windows user wouldn't even really notice that it happens, right?
Right.
Because of the speed of that. So, Corsair, as they usually do, announced quite a few new things at Computex as well. They announced an update to their AX1200 called the AX1200i DSP-based fully modular power supply that is as the name implies, 1200 watts, rated at 80 plus platinum, thanks in part to the digital power control technology to provide stable voltages, low ripple, and low noise levels. Who of you guys is using the AX1200?
Me?
I'm using it on our GPU test bed. I've been really impressed.
I've got it on the GPU test bed.
Yeah. So this is an update to that using DSP stuff, which is nice, fully modular. Is the AX1200 fully modular or is it just partially? I think it's just partially
modular. It's got some hardwired.
Like the ATX up. And the 8-pin and maybe one of the PCI.
Yeah, I think a pair of PCI Express.
Which makes sense to me. I never been one of those hardcore guys.
Resistance is a good thing, especially for the stuff that you're using all the time.
I've had some really, really smart power supply designers tell me that it really doesn't matter at this point, though. So either way, whatever. It's a new power supply, super high-end stuff. That's really cool. What else did they announce? A new Dominator module. This is actually one of the things I kind of thought Corsair was kind of backing out of the memory type of thing, maybe kind of like OCZ did a while ago, but apparently that's not the case. I thought that because for a while there, Corsair didn't have any of the high-frequency stuff for Ivy Bridge when Ivy Bridge first launched, like G-Skill and Patriot did and those guys as well. Well, they're apparently jumping back into that world of high-end consumer memory with the Dominator series. And what's interesting about this is it has a light bar that contains a user interchangeable light pipe, which lets enthusiasts tailor the downwash lighting color to match their PC lighting and components. All modules will ship with the white lights, and you'll be able to buy additional colors from Corsair to customize your configurations. So
It's RAM with mood lighting.
Yes. I wonder, I don't see that in here. Is it going to be able to be like turned on and off through like their Corsair software maybe? Yeah.
The assumption would be yes.
Some kind of, well, it would have to connect. Like there's the Corsair Link. Maybe you'd have to have Corsair Link technology to do that as well. Because there is a little 5-pin thing on the actual module itself that connects into Corsair Link so you can control it and that kind of deal. It's cool looking memory. As far as memory goes, we're going to have some of that in here soon.
Do you remember that LED memory, I think, in the DDR1 and DDR2 first generation that would actually, go from green to red, show you what kind of activity was going on with
DDR. Kind of like a histogram type thing.
Yeah.
And then they had one where it was actually text, and you could program text on it too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Plug it into the USB slot.
Those were cool. This is obviously only useful if you have a window on your case or an open.
If an
open
LED is giving you information in a closed case, is it really giving you the information?
Yeah. So they got speeds up to. Actually, interesting. The press release only mentioned speeds of 2800 megahertz, but on their website, on their blog, they mentioned 3000 megahertz stuff. So. I'm not really sure what the answer is there. And then, maybe most interestingly, they released announced a new Neutron SSD series driven by a controller company called Link-A Media Devices. And there are underscores in this company's name, which I find incredibly aggravating.
Annoying.
Alan, do we know anything about this Link-A Media Devices?
Nobody knows anything about these guys. And what's weird is that in the press release, which I read front to back, they have everything covered, like it's got trim support and it's at a 6 gigabit and it almost doesn't make sense because where did these guys come from and how are they making this?
Do we know anything about the company? Like what else did they do?
It looked like sort of embedded-ish kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really...
So it's an SoC chip company coming in to SSDs.
Yeah, that's kind of what it sounds like.
Or entering the other way.
Yeah, it's like the backwards way. Because, I mean, SSD controllers are basically SoCs, really.
Right.
But, I guess they somehow,
So it's going to be available in 120, 240, 480 gig versions, super high, 90,000.
Do you remember when SandForce first came out? Mm. Nobody knew about them.
That's true.
And they introduced this product that, kicked IndieLinks, kicked JMicron.
And thank God they came around.
The curb.
Yep.
And nobody really heard about SandForce until that first generation.
It's interesting. So do we know anything about when we're going to get one of these drives yet, Alan?
No, I'm pinging on them, but nothing back.
Yeah, they're all busy in Taiwan. When they get back, we'll bug them.
Yep.
So that's interesting. Kind of a, just maybe the potential for an entirely new player. And Corsair was kind of late in the game in getting into SSDs, right? So it's interesting to see them kind of maybe they're thinking about going the route that OCZ did with Indie Links, kind of like try to get kind of exclusive capabilities for a little while. Maybe they'll do that with this. I don't know if that's a good thing or not. We'll have to wait until we actually test it, but we'll see.
Yeah.
Matt Smith wrote up a post about NVIDIA wanting GeForce-equipped Ultrabooks to be a big popular thing. They're talking about some that were shown at Computex. Two from Gigabyte. We mentioned those earlier. Two from Acer. And one from Asus. Using anything from the GT620M to the GT650M. What I find maybe a little bit disappointing here, if you look at that table of options there that we're showing on the video version, is the Asus UX32 has the lowest end discrete GPU, but it has the highest resolution screen and also the smallest screen. So that seems to me to be like counterintuitive, right? You've got the 1080p screen with the lowest end GPU on the smallest screen, whereas you look at the Acer Ultrabook, the M5 581TG, it's a 15-inch screen, but only has a 13x7 resolution. So a little bit of difference there. I think I'd say just looking at that initial allotment, that it's a little bit disappointing. We kind of hoped NVIDIA would have more than that. NVIDIA is still very much, you know, telling us that there's going to be a lot of Ultrabooks with discrete GPUs. There's going to be a lot of notebooks, Ivy Bridge notebooks with discrete GPUs. They just, you know, everybody wanted to get their initial wave of Ivy Bridge systems out and available as quickly as possible without having to do as much designing. So that, you know, it explains why most of them are just using the integrated graphics still at this point. So, yeah. I don't know.
Designing hard.
Discrete GPU on an
hard.
Ultrabook.
Hard.
Probably. So difficult. Speaking of mobility discrete GPUs, Jeremy, you want to what is the GTX 680M, world's fastest mobile GPU? Verify or do you think they're just making it up?
Well, I think we need some further testing to happen because it, you know, really hasn't been benchmarked anywhere. But it looks really nice. They're talking about 80% better performance than their last high-end mobile part, the GTX 580M, and they're coming in at a conservative 30% bonus to 7970M from AMD, which sort of says that, you know, if they made laptops that actually had screens of decent resolution, this thing would actually be able to push out a lot of things. 720 megahertz on the clock on the core, memory's up to 1.8 megahertz with 4 gigs of memory to it on a 256-bit memory bus width. So it's a pretty impressive part. And
1,344 CUDA cores.
True.
Which compares to 1,536 on the desktop version of 680.
Yeah.
Right. So that's a lot. That's pretty close.
And, of course, it's going to support every single thing that we've come to expect from NVIDIA's new cards, up to and including SLI, which is the lovely thing because Alienware is actually going to be putting out a new series, which is going to be using the GTX 680M. And one of the models, the M18X, is going to have them in SLI. So it'll be 3D Vision enabled. Yeah. You'll have a laptop with SLI going, so it's not going to have any problems pushing 3D to the very small screen, which is kind of going to, you know, kind of ruin the 3D experience. But hey, you can output to something else and it's still going to be able to handle it. It's going to be nice. The slightly cheaper M17X is only going to have a single one. So, you know, it's still going to be a relatively impressive product. And moving off of the laptops for a minute, they also put out a new and very strangely colored Alienware Aurora, which they decided to go actually a little less power on it. Sorry, Josh. they actually went with the GTX 690 So instead of going with 680s and SLI, they went with 690. So you're looking at slightly lower thermals, slightly less power being used by the machine, and in theory, the chance to upgrade to the X2 version, which will have a pair of 690s in it, because it's probably the only way you're going to get a hold of those cards. It's almost as bad as the Mars cards were.
That's a desktop.
That one's a desktop.
Right? Okay, that's I was like, I hadn't heard of a 690 yet, so.
I mean, I went well over my 9 words, but I was trying to shove it along.
No, I gotcha. No, that's good. I'm really eager to test out the 680M. I just learned this since the 680 came out. The 670 and the 675M, the mobility parts from NVIDIA, are actually Fermi parts. And I think that's pretty crappy on their part to do that. So like the 680 is Kepler, and then the 650 and everything, maybe the 660 and everything and below is Kepler. But the 670
on the other hand, that's what they're doing on the desktop. The desktop, the 640 and below, are going to be the old architecture as well.
Yeah, you're right. So it's kind of backwards, isn't it? Yeah.
No, I thought there's one 640 that's Kepler.
Maybe. Oh.
Don't no, you right. love is. The confusion that they are sowing upon us?
The GT 640 is indeed a Kepler. I actually have one sitting over here.
Okay, so it's everything below that, 630, 610.
I don't know.
Horns coming out of my head.
All right, let's run through these last few things. Asus lights. Showing Mars 3. Card. This is a dual GTX 680 with 8 gigs of memory. It has 3 8-pin power connectors. It has 8 gigs of DDR5 memory. It has an SLI connector, so we assume that it'll be able to run 4-way SLI. It doesn't mention clock speeds, because what's interesting is when they made the Mars 2, it was cool because it had 2 full speed 580s on it, whereas the 590 had severely downclocked 580s, the official one from NVIDIA. But now the 690 has really, really close to stock 680s, two of them on a PCB. So I'm wondering if this is going to be overclocked to a certain degree. Otherwise,
well, you know, you can do the math of 3x8 pin plus.
Well, they could be adding a headroom and all
so
kinds
that's.
Of stuff.
That's 375 watts.
That's 525 watts, isn't it?
Yep.
3 8 pins? Each 8 pin is 100 watts, plus 75 from the slot.
I thought they were 125. No? I don't know.
Anyway.
It's a lot. It's a lot. I mean, it's one more than a 690, right? So you're getting 50% additional power compared to the 690. So it's interesting. It's going to be another one of those $1,200 to $1,500 video cards, maybe even more than that.
But you'll actually be able to buy it
as opposed
to buying the system wrapped around the card that you actually want?
Maybe. We'll see. 3D Mark showed, I actually stole some screenshots off of their website that were hidden in HTML as backgrounds. Yeah. Well, it happens. If you don't hide them very well on your website, we're going to take them. So if you want to see screenshots for 3D Mark for Windows 8, which is apparently what they're going to be calling this new benchmark, it was being shown at Computex at least a little bit. We found some screenshots on the website and posted them. It looks really cool. It looks. I think it was Tim that posted it, or it was Jeremy that posted it and said that it looked a lot like the Samaritan stuff from UE4. Yeah, so that's it looks really nice. We like these cool benchmarks. We like these cool demos. We like things that show off graphics.
It looks like somebody took pictures with stinking Instagram.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that's not the benchmark. That is really like an after kind of thing, post-process that they did on it. But
Josh, tell me about... It would be running
on a tablet. It could be. Yeah, you're right. You're right. We'll see how all-encompassing in Windows 8 they are. Maybe they'll even run on Wart. I doubt it, but maybe. Josh, tell me about Brazos 2 and why it's not that super exciting.
They use the same stinking Zuccotti chips as they did with the original Brazos, except that over the past year and a half, they've improved the fabrication of said processors so they could increase the high end by 50 megahertz to run it at 1.7 gigahertz instead of 1.65 for the high end E2-1800. Otherwise, they're calling the new graphics portion the HD 7340, I believe.
which is exactly the same as the HD 5000 series of graphics processors that we were introduced to in 2009. So it's a VLIW5 80 stream unit. And I'm not being redundant, but I'm not clearing my throat, so that's positive. But yeah, the biggest change that we see is that in the Southbridge, the Hudson M3L, I believe, is the latest one that is called. It features two native USB 3.0 ports. It has up to, I believe, six SATA 6G ports, and it also includes a new SD memory reader / controller. As well as those things, they've decreased the idle power from something like 900 milliwatts down to 750 milliwatts. Now, in between the process advances that we've seen on the original Zuccotti chips and the Southbridge, they're expecting 5 to 7% increase in battery life at slightly higher speeds and this higher specification in terms of Southbridges and IOs. So it's kind of a win for them, but at the same time, it's not really a big jump. Sure, it's better than last year's product, but it's not that great of a thing. And when we're looking at products based on the 17-watt TDP Ultrabook processors and their Southbridges, it kind of loses a little bit of their value because they're not quite hitting that same TDP. But at the same time, these are a little bit more optimized for mobile use. And I think that when you actually see them run for 11 hours straight, actually being able to do things, that's going to be something that these 17-watt TDP normal CPUs from AMD and Intel in terms of Ivy Bridge and Trinity, they'll probably not be able to compete with. So this is, you know, it's a good little upgrade, but it's a little upgrade.
All right. Jeremy, you want to give me a quick rundown of another? We've got a couple little final ASUS stories here. One is some ROG gear that was just kind of pictured, not a whole lot of detail on, but what did they show for the first time here at Computex again? You should unmute while you talk to us, though.
But that way I make more sense.
Yeah, I know.
But no, the Republic of Gamers has come out with a single product so far. The Zonar Phoebus, the nice sound card that we've seen pictured quite a few different places and that looks, you know, like something that would be nice because it's been a while since we've seen a new sound card. They also have a whole bunch of products with no official release date whatsoever, unfortunately. You've got three motherboards, the Maximus 5, two models of a motherboard. The Maximus 5 Extreme, which comes with the good old ROG Connect and that happy little overclocking tool that they've got, which essentially sits between on your DVI port and it gives you an on-screen display, which not only displays what your current overclocks are, but gives you direct control to be able to overclock your card.
Right.
They also have the Formula, which is a nice little small board, but the Formula Thunder FX is really the one that's worth talking about because it comes with a nice little digital signal processor headphone amp on the side, which gives you really a serious piece of audio equipment. 120 decibel signal to noise ratio. It's got built-in noise cancellation so that even if you didn't buy the noise canceling earphones, it should more or less be able to handle that. It also has an onboard evolution of the original version of the Formula's audio, and I cannot remember what its name was. Supreme FX, the new version of Supreme FX, so if you prefer speakers to headphones. And as you can look, if Burke will show a picture, it has some very significant heat sinks, which feature one very important feature. There's already water cooling barbs on them. So if you do want to go for a water-cooled system, the chipset of the motherboard can also be included in your cooling loop. A very nice thing for those that don't want to have extra fans on the machine just to try and move air over the chipset, which is completely and totally out of your cooling loop. They put out a new graphics card, the Gamers Matrix 7970, 3 gigabytes of GDDR5 memory with a nice dual fan control. dual fans and heat pipe assisted cooling. So it's going to be thick. It's going to be three slots thick.
Nice.
On the other hand, you get two DVI. I believe it's one dual, one single, and four full-sized, not many, full-sized display ports.
Pretty
so
nice.
It'll natively support six monitors. It is still, and I must remind you, going to take up three slots.
Yeah, and it's got the bio switch on there that switches back from one single link, two DVI, and three display port to two single link DVIs and four display ports. Clear as mud?
Yeah.
All right.
It's an interesting thing. On the audio side, you've got a pair of headsets. You've got the Orion and the Vulcan Pro ANC. The Orion is a good old USB-based one, so no drivers. The Vulcan Pro is the analog version, so for those of you that actually can tell the difference between good audio and bad audio, should pick that up and pair it with Thunder FX. You can also pick up a nice little digital signal processor, which will stand on its own. And just to wrap it up, you get a nice brand new Republic of Gamers branded laptop. We know very little about it. In fact, almost nothing. But it's got at least two USB ports, a DVD drive, mic in, headphone output, an SD card reader. And considering that the keyboard is so big that it actually has a numpad on it, I think you can expect this is going to be a fairly large overall laptop and hopefully a decent resolution.
17 inches or larger would be my guess.
So it's going to be 1340 by 768, right?
And that would just look awful. God, that would look awful.
Oh, man. Asus also showed off a couple of a couple of beastly concept motherboards, as Tim posted here. One is called the Zeus. And what's interesting is that it doesn't have any PCI Express slots.
Are you sure that's not pronounced Zeus?
No, I guess I'm not. It's a Socket 2011 motherboard, X79 chipset, 8 DIMM slots, but it has no PCI Express slots. Instead, it has two GPUs embedded on the PCB itself running in Crossfire. Tech PowerUp believes that the GPUs are AMD 7800 Pitcairn series mobile graphics cards because they are passively cooled, right? There doesn't appear to be any active fans. There's no kind of water cooling barbs on it. This is like, and you can see the PCI Express power connectors at the bottom of the motherboard are very interesting. I think there's
two eights, two sixes. Yeah.
So like you would, yeah. You would have enough for, you know, for each graphics card. This is one of those things that's like, it's never going to be sold, guys. It's cool to see. It's never going to be sold because who wants to be bottled into the 7800 so specifically yet is okay upgrading their processor and that kind of stuff. It just doesn't make
sense. It's like the Voodoo 3 that was shown in pictures to be integrated on a motherboard back in 1999.
We saw one of those in... Yeah, we saw one at Computex with Asus last time. I forget what it was. Ken might remember. I think it was like a 5000 series AMD card, single GPU embedded on a board. But, you know, whatever. They also showed off one called the Wolverine. What is this one?
40 power phase units.
Oh, my.
Because more is better.
More is better.
A lot of MOSFETs.
So that's actually a marketable motherboard, probably. It looks like something you could actually purchase and install. But I don't know. Again, it's one of those things.
Only if it comes with neon lighting and vinyl to put on your case.
Obviously.
Yeah.
So that's going to round out the Computex for the show, guys. Like I said, we went through a lot of stuff very quickly. If you want to check out all the stuff that you may have missed or that you think we glossed over, you can actually go to pcpro.com/Computex and you'll see all of our posts that are tagged with Computex, and that's all the stuff we talked about today plus a few extras that we didn't even have time to kind of gloss over. So let's quickly get into our hardware software picks of the week. I'm going to pick... Did you guys hear of the Kickstarter that was called the Limbal? It's basically like a USB attachment that allows you to have your smartphone kind of propped up next to a display or something like that for a dumb reason. almost completely unrelated. This is the Asus USB N53, just a USB wireless adapter that we're using on our test beds here while in Austin because we don't have a wired network. But the reason I bring this up is because it comes with one of these. I call it the bendy straw. This just allows you to... It extends the USB connection for your wireless device and then kind of bend it to whatever shape you want, except for the shape that Josh really wants.
I don't want that. I don't want it.
He's got nine of them, actually. Josh, I just thought it was ironic that this apparently is a Kickstarter worth a total now of $88,000 to build something that allows you to plug in a USB port on the side of your monitor and then tilt it up so you can have, you know, your cell phone there. So maybe a little bit stronger version of this, but that's it. The N53 itself is actually a really good wireless device. Pretty good speeds, dual band, and it's $39 at Newegg. So that's pretty nice. Jeremy, what do you got?
Well, my pick is certainly not this.
Ooh, a new work phone.
Yes,
you see, Canadians are trying to support their nationalized BlackBerry company that's about ready to go under.
But the Canadian government threw so much money in of our pension money into RIM, and you know, said that RIM would make a lot of money.
Pooched. Sorry,
back when it was worth 150 or so, and now it's worth like 10. Yeah. On the plus side, you know, the federal government in the U.S. has actually approved the new BlackBerry operating system as secure enough to be able to be used there. So I think they're, you know, going to be propped up for forever. But, yeah.
Good for you. Good for you. Welcome to the new age. Josh, what do you got?
On the other hand, Mozilla's got a sense of humor. Well when you update it to 12, it doesn't need administrative access to update. It actually won't update in a corporate environment. It also won't tell the user. It's a good thing.
For it.
Josh.
For it. Josh.
Me.
Did you get a cell phone?
No, I didn't get a cell phone. But I've been building some computers at work, and I've been using this case, and I love it. The Corsair, what is it? Stinking.
I don't know, dude. What did you pick?
300R. Carbide 300R. Yep. $79 on sale. It is so damn roomy. It's well built. It's still pretty quiet, even though it's made primarily of mesh. Keeps clean, looks nice, very sharp. I've been using these older Cooler Master $59 units, and they're just a pain in the butt to work with. This is like heaven. So if you're a system builder, you want something that's roomy, it's not going to give you a lot of grief. Still good expandability, and it looks nice. For only $80 right now, it's a wonderful little case. Well constructed, comes with all kinds of little accessories. I really like it. I'm glad Corsair brought something like this to the market because it was needed really badly for people who actually build computers for standard users.
That rounds up Alan. There you go. He stole one, apparently.
Well, no. I got a message from someone from one of our readers earlier today, actually. Even before Scott put it on the Yammer. About a Samsung A30 Series 256 gig at Tiger Direct for $200. Actually, $199.
It's $249 with a $50 coupon. It's not a mail-in rebate. It's actually a coupon. And yeah. I went in and added two to my cart, and you apply the coupon, and it takes $100 off. So it's actually $50 per drive that you buy, not just $50 one-time use coupon. So
I wish everybody listening to this the best of luck that they may still possibly be in stock by the time you hear this. Sorry.
Yeah. So what's that come out to be? $77 a gig.
Yeah,
it's pretty good.
There's like another $10 off if you like haven't gone to Tiger Direct in a while. This little thing pops up if you sit on the page for a few seconds. Says like, yeah, there's you can get $10 off. Also, twist my arm.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that is going to round out the show, our Computex extravaganza. Thank you, guys. Like I said, again...
Hey, wait, we didn't cover E3. Should we start on that now?
Yeah, we're going to do another episode right after this where we're going to record it. But I'm replacing all of you guys with Scott because...
Oh, no, it's Josh in paint.
Oh, that's not as good. Apparently, somebody in the chat room said that Unreal Engine 4 is going to be unveiled tomorrow, like... in more detail. So that's actually really cool. I'm looking forward to seeing that. E3 is going on. Not a whole lot of PC specific news there yet, except when they get back from E3, I'm probably going to drive up to id Software and try to get my hands on that head mounted
VR.
The VR rig that Carmack invented or cobbled together and they're going to start selling units of and that kind of stuff. So that's interesting. I'm going to get some hands-on time with that. So we'll do that, but we'll cover that in a future article and episode of the show. So pcpro.com/podcast. You can go find our show notes there if you are listening to this and you want to get links to all of the articles we talked about, or you can just go to pcpro.com or pcpro.com/computex to see a list of all the Computex stories that we talked about, maybe glossed over a little bit too quickly, even in our extended length episode here this week. So we thank everybody for joining us. We will talk to you next week. I'm Ryan Schrout.
I'm Jeremy Hellstrom.
I'm Josh Walrath.
And I'm Alan Malventano, not coughing.
Talk to you guys later.